He advocated for the equality of white women and also for the genocide of indigenous people. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Thursday, April 15th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the complicated legacy of author L. Frank Baum. He came to the hub city of Aberdeen seeking his fortune. His dreams were dashed and his values revealed, but he also found a story in the cracked earth of drought-plagued plain. We'll talk about America's first fairy tale and the man who brought it into the world. Then we dive deeper into South Dakota's literary heritage. How might an obscure book in the Rapid City Public Library change the way you understand your home? Seth Tupper joins us. Plus, poet and literary scholar Joshua Bennett returns to celebrate words, including the ones we only share with one another. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The South Dakota High School Activities Association is recommending schools hold off on submitting any transgender athlete waiver applications. Governor Kristi Noem recently issued two executive orders that could be at odds with a federal Justice Department memo. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Governor Noem's executive orders state that only girls, based on a determination at birth, can play girls' sports. Critics say that ultimately prevents transgender girls from playing girls' sports. There are currently no transgender girl athletes doing that. Dan Suardos is the director of the Activities Association. He says they recommend schools wait to see if the courts settle the issue or the legislature takes it up.
Our advice to schools has been to sit tight on it for now and see what happens within the legislature and within the court system.
Suardos says he believes their policy is legally sound and in line with the memo put out by the Department of Justice last week.
In the absence of a court addressing this specific situation, we feel that our policy is where it needs to be.
Since the governor's executive orders, the association has not received any applications for a transgender athlete waiver. Governor Noem wants to call a special session, either in late May or early June, to address the issue. Her office has not released any draft proposals. A Republican leader in the Senate says that chamber has little appetite to take up the issue. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Health officials are temporarily halting the use of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine. The pause comes after six women developed rare blood clots within 3 weeks of being vaccinated. It's forced some South Dakota universities to change their vaccine rollout plans. SDPB's Megan Feary has more.
South Dakota State University planned an on-campus vaccine clinic this week using the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Laura Dirks is the public health specialist for SDSU. She says they've vaccinated almost 900 students with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine so far. They were planning over 400 more vaccinations this week.
We obviously have canceled that and put that on hold as well, as we're waiting to hear back if there's any updated information from CDC and FDA. So for now, we're having our students look elsewhere in the community for that opportunity.
Dirks says the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was ideal for college students.
Part of the reason that we gravitated towards that vaccine and why Brookings Health chose to allocate that to SDSU is that as we're nearing the end of that semester, especially for our on-campus students, that two-dose requirement with that four-week separation is not ideal and not always possible as students go home.
The University of South Dakota also planned to use the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at an on-campus clinic. They coordinated with Sanford Health and managed to switch to Moderna vaccines. Kevin O'Kelly is USD's Assistant Vice President of Research Compliance. He says even with the last-minute change, almost 80 students showed up to get their first dose.
Yes, the second shot will have to be after you get home, and I'm very, very proud of them for sticking with the plan and getting vaccinated, even though it's not the more convenient Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Both Dirks and O'Kelly say the future of their vaccine rollout plans depends on CDC and FDA recommendations. But they both say students and staff should get vaccinated however they can. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Megan Feary.
Today's weather, mostly cloudy skies. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Results from a recent University of Nebraska study could dramatically increase demand for ethanol. That's optimistic news for South Dakota corn farmers, ethanol manufacturers, and family farm advocates. SDPB's Lur Rohde has the story.
Refining renewable fuels was a year-long study conducted by researchers from the University of Nebraska Department of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering. The study's data shows that non-flex fuel vehicles can safely run on higher ethanol blends like E30 and at the same time reduce carbon emissions. These results could have big implications for corn producers, ethanol manufacturers, and our environment, explains the study's author and lead researcher, Rajib Saha.
If 10% of the 1.7 million registered non-fuel vehicle that we have in Nebraska, if 10% of these vehicles are converted from E10 to E30 vehicle, then these corresponding numbers are more, 18.5 million gallons more ethanol consumption per year, and the corresponding CO2 emission decrease by 64,000 tons per year.
Saha designed the study to monitor the performance of 50 state of Nebraska fleet vehicles. Driven for 1 year between January 2019 and January 2020, 26 cars were fueled with 15% ethanol, or E15, and 24 were fueled with 30% ethanol, or E30. The non-flex fuel vehicles were 6 to 8 years old. Saha's team measured engine speed, engine timing, air temperature, CO2 emissions, and 12 other parameters, in the end collecting millions and millions of data points.
And we didn't see any statistical difference between the E30 blend compared to what other blends that we use, E10 and E15.
If drivers were to increase their ethanol consumption by 15 to 20%, the impact would be felt by the more than 11,000 South Dakota corn farmers. Farmers like Keith Alverson, who is a sixth-generation Chester, South Dakota producer. Each harvest, 90% of Alverson's corn crop is trucked 10 miles from his family's farm fields to Dakota Ethanol Plant in Wentworth.
You know, having increasing demand is always important in a commodity market because we've seen the pace that our yields are going up with new technology and, you know, improved farming practices and new genetics, things along that line. And so, you know, farmers tend to just be growing more. And so having demand keep up or, you know, try and keep pace or slightly outstrip our pace is something that's, you know, good from my eyes as a farmer.
Alverson says the local market ethanol creates for corn benefits not only farmers, but also the entire community.
Having that local demand really improved the basis. So that's money in our pockets and money in our local communities and you know, really gets turned over within our state. And so that's, you know, in my mind, certainly better to have that than sending those that money out of state.
The fact that non-flex fuel vehicles experienced no negative side effects when they were fueled by 30% ethanol did not surprise Jim Sire. Sire is CEO of Glacial Lakes Energy Cooperative, an ethanol manufacturer headquartered about 85 miles north of the Alverson Farm in Watertown. This year, its four plants are on target to buy some 123 million bushels of corn from farmers to produce nearly 360 million gallons of ethanol. In 2016, Glacial Lakes Energy partnered with local gas stations, drivers, and area mechanics to implement a similar study. They called it the E30 Challenge. And since it began, drivers in Watertown and Aberdeen have purchased more than 7 million gallons of E30 and driven more than 150 million miles with no issues. E30's ability to reduce CO2 emissions, however, was news to Sire.
Obviously, as we look for ways to become more environmentally friendly, it really validates the role that ethanol can play.
Corn farmer Keith Alverson agrees.
As we see big demand just from the environmental aspects of ethanol, and carbon is front and center on that. You know, states like California have a low carbon fuel standard where they actually incentivize fuels that will reduce carbon emissions versus gasoline. And, you know, ethanol has been a key contributor and big player in that. And so markets like that are driven off the value of carbon and carbon reduction. And so, you know, having a study like this that shows about, you know, the amount of carbon emissions that were reduced essentially turns into a demand driver. And so, in my mind, I think the carbon aspect is really going to be the driver going forward for our ethanol markets.
Currently, the EPA has not approved non-flex fuel vehicles to run on E30. Rajiv Saha says he wants to conduct one more study before the team recommends the EPA approve E30 for all vehicles. Saha sees the second study looking a bit more like the E30 challenge, where instead of testing fleet vehicles driven by state employees, everyday drivers would be asked to participate. He is hopeful this summer he can begin that study. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lura Rohde.
In a few moments, we are going to explore the complicated legacy of author L. Frank Baum and how his time in the Hub City influenced America's first fairy tale, The Wizard of Oz. It's ahead of a new documentary that premieres Monday. That's ahead on In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Business and Community Development Reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota. The annual Arts Education Institute, Band Director Institute, and First Annual Choral Director Institute go online July 12th through the 16th with grad credit available. Register at artssouthdakota.org.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state. Informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Howlett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. And the best part, your gift this week will be matched by a group of the Sound Vision Campaign donors. SDPB. Building community, one story at a time.
The exploration of cutting-edge products and services being offered in South Dakota is highlighted on our Science and Technology Beat, supported on SDPB by Black Hills Information Security.
You are listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh, and joining me from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hills studio, we have Mr. Seth Tupper for a special edition of our spring membership drive, as we are dedicating part of our airtime to the SDPB Sound Vision campaign. Nice to hear your voice again, Seth.
Thanks, Lori. Yep, we're in the final phase of this vital campaign, and to inspire you to help us close it out, a group of generous donors has offered to match all gifts up to a total of $50,000. By meeting this important challenge, we'll have $100,000 to invest in inspiring local programming like In the Moment, Dakota Life, and resources such as our beautiful Black Hills studio, where I'm sitting today and watching it snow out the front windows here in Rapid City.
Oh, no.
That's okay. SDPB has an exciting future ahead. That's why I came to work here. But we still need your help to wrap up this critical campaign and help build community one story at a time. We'd like to thank a few people who've helped us do that already. Charles from Custer, James and Lena from Sturgis, and Edward from Rapid City. Thank you very much for those gifts. And you can join them by calling 800-333-0789 or by giving online at sdpb.org.
This phase of the Sound Vision campaign is focused on local SDP programming and reporters. And there you've got Seth Tupper looking out the window and telling you that it's snowing. I can tell you that the wind has finally died down here in the city of Sioux Falls. And it's because of people like you that we have these studio spaces. When we talk about stories in South Dakota, this is proof that they are being told by the people who live here, who are dealing with the snow and the wind and the rain and the drought and all the things. We see you, we hear you, you are our neighbors, and you can be part of this community as well because it is such a vital public resource. If you have never made a gift to South Dakota Public Broadcasting, what a great time when you have these leaders stepping up with $50,000 of matching gift. If that's not a call to action and an inspiration, take a breath and think again. Give online at sdpb.org or call 800-333-0789.
And this campaign, Lori, is all about building community, and we do that in a lot of ways. One way we do that, and we'll do that tonight, is One Song at a Time with Carl Gerke and Jazz Nightly. Every weekday evening, he shares amazing stories of jazz artists and their music. That's also part of the mission of SDPB and Jazz Nightly to provide a forum for local musicians with live shows and audience participation. I've attended those shows here in Rapid City in the Black Hill Studio, where we hope to have more people attending those shows soon as it becomes safer to do so. And you can help make that happen by going online to sdpb.org or calling to make a gift at 800-333-0789.
So another way we do that, One Song at a Time. And by the way, if I put a dollar in a jar every time I listened to Carl Gerke on Jazz Nightly at night and then waited for membership drive and sent that money into SDPB, it would be a large pile of cash. So think about that for a minute. How many days do you listen to In the Moment? How many days do you tune in, you know, in the carpool lane to listen to Morning Edition or All Things Considered? How often do you tune in to Carl Gerke or click online? Well, do that clicking online at sdpb.org and click that big red donate button, because this is part of the Sound Vision campaign. It builds community, and it is so easy. Call 800-333-0789.
And maybe another way we should give is give a dollar every time we listen to your show, Lori, which, of course, brings us great interviews and segments every day. It's In the Moment is a locally produced program that features authentic interviews, conversations with newsmakers, scholars, artists, and everyday South Dakotans. And you and your producers do this show every day with intelligence, fairness, compassion, and imagination. And this is one of the programs that brings our listeners into the conversations and keeps them in the moment.
Yeah. Well, to date, gifts from all those generous donors who inspire me have opened these beautiful studios in the Black Hills and Sioux Falls, as well as boutique studios in Aberdeen and Brookings. We're going to have a story here about Aberdeen, the hub city, in a moment, and L. Frank Baum and his complicated legacy. There's another studio in Pine Ridge on the way, and we've also initiated new programming, such as a complete reimagining of how we make radio on In the Moment and a Dakota Life virtual. We've had people like Seth Tupper join our organization and really elevate that level of local journalism even higher, and people like Richard Tubbles, who are just remarkable additions. Seth, I could talk to Richard Tubbles on the radio all day long, and he brings such a heart to his reporting as he finds a story of somebody that he has interviewed and meet, and then he immediately tells us how it relates to his life as a father, as a South Dakotan, as a tribal member. People like Seth and Richard have made our organization so much better. So I'm just going to wrap it up here so we can talk about Aberdeen and L. Frank Baum. But Seth, thanks so much, and we'll see you in a little bit, because we're going to talk about heading down to the Rapid City Library and finding a book that changes the way you see South Dakota, and that's ahead. It's a show that really explores our literary heritage, and it's all because of listeners like you. Go online to sdpb.org or call 800-333-0789, and thank you.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Hi, this is Carol Johnson. You are listening to the SDPB Drive for the Sound Vision Campaign. My husband Al and I are supporting a matching gift challenge for this drive. Every gift made this week will be matched dollar for dollar. Just being a Friends board member is not enough for us. As strong believers in SDPB and its mission, we feel the need to help kickstart the campaign and to encourage you to join us with a gift of your own.
A successful campaign will allow SDPB to expand access for viewers and listeners, continue innovation in programming, and expand educational services through the Early Learning Initiative. Join us today. Make a gift to the Sound Vision campaign and double your impact. Go online at sdpb.org or call 800-333-0789.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. Even the wireless revolution needs a lifeline, and SDN is happy to provide 50,000 miles of broadband fiber support. More at sdncommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Author L. Frank Baum sought his fortune in the hub city of Aberdeen, South Dakota, before he wrote America's first fairy tale and helped revolutionize children's literature. He was, among other things, a shopkeeper who opened a bazaar of wonders in a booming town, only to have his hopes dashed and his values tested. A new documentary explores the life and times of author L. Frank Baum and how his time in South Dakota helped create The Wizard of Oz. Written, directed, and produced by Randall McLowry and Tracy Heather Strain, American Oz premieres Monday night on American Experience. You can see it at 9 p.m. Central on SDPB TV. And we're going to talk today with Randall and Tracy Heather here ahead of the program. Randall McLowry, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tracy Heather Strain, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you so much. We're delighted to be here.
So there is so much in this documentary about his childhood and his relationship with his family, his marriage, his time in Chicago and the White City, and how that sort of influences the Emerald City and how it unfolds in Oz. But of course, you're in South Dakota, and we want to talk about his time in Aberdeen. What brings L. Frank Baum and his family to the Hub City? What kind of connection does he have here, and what is he seeking to do? Which one of you wants to kick us off with that?
Sure.
Okay.
Go ahead, Tracy.
So
L. Frank Baum grew up on the outskirts of Syracuse, and he had relatives that had moved to Dakota Territory, specifically to Aberdeen. And he was traveling as a salesman, and he visited his brother-in-law in Aberdeen, and came and started thinking about the possibilities for himself, and came back east and wrote a letter saying, "I think that in your territory, a man can be someone." And so he moved himself and his family out to Aberdeen to try to be somebody. So that's how he got there.
He creates this wonderful bazaar, which is, you know, filled with imagination and whimsy and creativity and showmanship. And then a drought comes, and things that were promised are revealed to have not been completely true about what exactly it's like to live and to farm and to work in a city like Aberdeen, in a place like Dakota Territory. Randall, tell me a little bit about how things come crashing down from a business standpoint around his ears.
Sure. I mean, you know, at the time, you know, Aberdeen was really being presented as this place of great growth, and people were being sold on the idea that it would be this verdant place, and everything would basically be very simple in terms of being successful as a farmer, and that was really what Aberdeen was going to be, sort of the breadbasket of the West. And so, and Baum's idea is he's going to help by selling goods to all these farmers and settlers that are coming to make their lives there. And for a while it's successful, while things are going well, and he really does enchant, I think, the community there. His opening day on October 1st, 1888, he has 1,000 people show up at his store in this small town of Aberdeen, which is a booming town that's growing. But, you know, for that part of the country, I think that's pretty amazing that he was able to draw in so many people. And that year and that summer, it turns into one of the sort of the toughest droughts America had seen at that time, and you know the economy really crumbles around him, and that you know that the people that if you don't have money for seed or for food or to be able to feed your children, you're no longer going to be coming into town and buying toys and novelties and luxuries that were what Frank Baum was trying to sell in Baum's Bazaar.
Yeah.
So he failed in that his dream failed in that essence.
Yeah, for South Dakota listeners and viewers who are interested in this documentary, they also might be interested in the fact that Sally Rush Wagner, who's a frequent guest on this program, is featured in it. Philip Deloria, which is a name that many people know here, as well as Janine Basinger from Brookings, talking about film history. And Sally says in this program, history is never, you know, either and it is or either or it is both and. And so we must talk about the work that L. Frank Baum does on behalf of women's suffrage and women's equality. He's a really early feminist, which we see in The Wizard of Oz with the notion of a good witch and a bad witch and this heroine of Dorothy. But he is also explicit in his desire to eradicate this land of indigenous people, really without mercy. His words are shocking. Tracy, help us understand the role that he was in, where he was saying these kinds of things and trying to influence other people that they were conquerors and needed to conquer completely, and how we look at that legacy now.
So, so Baum's thinking was a lot of America's thinking at the time. Just the idea of him moving west, and people tended to conceptualize an empty West in many cases, and there were people there. And so in our documentary, we show that, and we show that Baum at first was such a booster that he was ignoring calls for people who were becoming fearful because the ghost dance was becoming prevalent, and the U.S. government subsequently outlaws this dance because it's being perceived as the Lakota Sioux and other Native tribes becoming ready to attack, right? And so there was a kind of white fear. And Baum was trying to, at first, not succumb to that. He really thought that it would ruin the chances for Aberdeen to become a great place if people were afraid to come. But then things changed, and he kind of joined in, jumped in the bandwagon of this thinking that the best way to handle things is to wipe out the remaining Native Americans. And it is a troubling thing to read, but it's not thinking that is uncommon, and it was prevalent thinking. And
yeah.
So on the one hand, it isn't surprising, you know, and on the
right,
other hand,
right,
we see Baum as this figure who's written this beloved children's book. You don't want to think of him writing things like that.
Right. And Randall, as filmmakers, why was it important for you to include that through line, which really begins as he goes west and continues throughout the piece, so that we see him as a fully faceted person and don't gloss over the fact that the same person who gave us the Yellow Brick Road also gave us some of these words that have a legacy that lives on in this area today?
We're looking at the full life of L. Frank Baum, and he lived through a very transformative time. And, you know, his time out in Dakota Territory really was very formative. And I think that, you know, that was a large part of what was happening out there, and he was witness to it, and he responded to it. And so, you know, I think that makes, you know, I think you need to understand the fuller complexity of a human being when you're looking at when you're looking at a life, and the fact that he, you know, both carried those sentiments in him as well as his tolerance towards women shows a sense of complexity to humanity in general, and you know, it doesn't diminish the power of the story that he creates and has become so much a part of the American fabric and consciousness. So I think it's really important to look, as Phil DeLore says, look into the corners of people's lives, and to, you have to make your own sense of what that individual, who that individual was.
Yeah, and one of the beautiful things I think about that is people think of children's literature as a nice little story, and yet here's a man on the cusp of a new century who can take his experience with drought and world-weary, you know, Midwesterners, and weave it into an experience of, you know, the Wizard of Menlo Park and the lights going up over Chicago and a new future. And if you really unpack The Wizard of Oz, all that is there waiting for you alongside A Whopping Good Tale. So American Experience presents American Oz on Monday night. It's at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV. My guests have been Randall McLowry and Tracy Heather Strain, the filmmakers of this project. Randall, thanks so much for being here. Tracy, thanks as well.
Thank you so much. Delighted. Thank you.
Are you getting married soon and live in the Mitchell area? Be sure to sign up for the 5th Annual Mitchell Bridal Showcase. It's at the Highland Conference Center on Sunday, April 18th. Doors open at noon, and vendors will be on site until 3 p.m. Weekend weather in that area calls for sunny skies with highs in the 50s and 60s. May your wedding day be just as bright. If dancing is your thing, maybe it's been a while since you pulled on your dancing boots. Next week, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, it's the Black Hills Dance Festival. It's at the Monument, formerly known as the Rushmore Plaza Civic Center in Rapid City. It's a weekend of dance workshops and performances coupled with a whole lot of fun. Tomorrow night at the Monument in Rapid, you'll find hockey action as the Rapid City Rush take on the Allen Americans. Tomorrow in western South Dakota, you've got a chance of snow and rain. Tomorrow night should be mostly cloudy and windy with lows in the upper 20s. Tomorrow night in Sioux Falls, don't miss the Hegg Brothers live at the R Wine Bar and Kitchen on East 8th Street in downtown Sioux Falls. The music plays from 6:30 to 9:30. Tomorrow and Saturday, also in Sioux Falls, is an event that aims to shepherd parents and caregivers into a deeper understanding of their children's needs. The Hope for the Journey Conference is at Ransom Church West Campus. That's on Ebenezer Avenue. Weather-wise, eastern South Dakotans can expect mostly cloudy skies tomorrow with a high near 50, much of the same on Saturday, only partly sunny. Up next, we take a deeper look into our literary heritage. SDPB's Seth Tupper is with us here on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting Voting Why It Matters, featuring virtual events with authors, activists, and scholars, including Gloria Steinem, Louise Erdrich, and Thomas E. Patterson. More at sdhumanities.org.
Every story has a beginning. Think back to when your journey with SDPB began. Was it waking up with Morning Edition? Finishing your day with Jazz Nightly? SDPB is your constant companion during your commute, whether that is across town or across the state, informing you in times of crisis, or beginning a relaxing weekend with laughter on Saturday morning. SDPB has been part of the fabric of South Dakota for nearly a century, and SDPB is part of your story. I'm Ryan Hallett, the Development Director at Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This week, we're asking for your support to continue to make outstanding news and entertainment on the radio. Please consider a gift. You can do so online at sdpb.org/donate or by calling 800-333-0789. And the best part, your gift this week will be matched by a group of the Sound Vision campaign donors. SDPB, building community one story at a time.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, today we're going to dive into our literary heritage with the beginning of a series on the state's iconic, lesser known, and even quirky literary offerings. SDPB's Seth Tupper is often exploring the Black Hills of South Dakota. Well, recently a book he checked out from the Rapid City Library helped him understand the place where he lives just a little bit better. Seth is joining us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio at SDPB's Black Hills Studio. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for having me on.
So this is such a captivating story, and it involves a Civil War veteran and well-known Ambrose Bierce, right? Tell me a little bit about the book that you found.
Correct. Well, the book is called Ambrose Bierce and the Black Hills, quite simply. And, you know, to back up a little bit, the reason it caught my attention, Ambrose Bierce, as you said, was a Civil War veteran, very well-known journalist, short fiction writer, etc. Many people say his story, The Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, a short fiction story, was one of the greatest short stories ever written, one of the most anthologized. And so I read that story. I was assigned to read it in middle school, and it kind of blew my middle school mind. I can still remember how I felt, the gut punch I felt at the end of that story. Yeah. It has a twist ending, and it talks about the realities of war, et cetera. So it was really affecting for me. Our English teacher at the time, Lon Chilson, maybe he's out there listening today at Kimball Middle School, was one who assigned that. And we did a great writing assignment where we took a different character in the story and wrote a narrative from their perspective about the same events. And so it's always stayed with me. And then 30 years later, I'm in the Black Hills and living here, and I've hiked the Flume Trail many times, which is this hiking trail that traces the route of the roughly 20-mile flume from Spring Creek to Rockerville that was built in the 1880s to get water over to Rockerville so they could wash gold out of the gravel deposits over there. And it's this crazy snake-like trail, and the flume was basically like a wooden canal or wooden box on stilts that snaked through the Black Hills and went through rock tunnels. So I had a little bit of knowledge of the Flume Trail, but here I am, and I'm in the library, and I'm deciding to kind of read through some of their South Dakota history section. I start with Ambrose Bierce in the Black Hills, and I think this is right up my alley. And so these two things kind of converge, and I read the book, and I realize that for 4 months in 1880, the guy who was in charge of building the Rockerville Flume was none other than Ambrose Bierce. He had moved out here to try to strike it rich in the Black Hills, and took leadership of this Black Hills Placer Mining Company to try to build this flume. And that's all detailed in this book.
And so we have been covering Brian Gevick and Heather Benson and really asking people to share the Civil War stories of their ancestors. But these people who fought in a war had the trauma of the war, which, you know, Bierce writes about, and finding their way out west. How does he... Is he descriptive? Does he describe the scenery, the landscape? Is he characterize him as a writer in this particular text?
You know, not really, and that's what's funny about it. So the guy who wrote the book, Paul, is his first name, and I don't know how he pronounces his last name. It's F-A-T-O-U-T. He was an English professor at Purdue. He wrote this book in the 50s and has since passed on. He does include a lot of excerpts from Bierce's letters that he wrote from Rockerville back to the East Coast, where the investors in this endeavor, the Black Hills Flume, resided. And it was a miserable 4 months for Bierce. You know, Bierce's nickname is Bitter Bierce, and the author actually speculates that Bierce's 4 months in the Black Hills is one of the things that made him so bitter. Because the company was really badly run. The investors in New York were constantly meddling in the affairs of the company and splitting authority. And Bierce actually, never got a salary the 4 months he was out here. He just lived on company money, apparently on the expectation that he would be rewarded later. He never was. And so the writing he did from the Black Hills was really just a lot of angry back and forth with these investors in the East who were, trying to micromanage him while he was out here trying to make a go of this flume in the Black Hills. And so, but he did, it's really interesting. He wrote letters to the Rapid City Journal while he was out here and really did leave a mark. There's a significant amount of correspondence that's covered in this book that he wrote from Rockerville while he was here.
Yeah, well, I will shamelessly plug your local library. One of the reasons we wanted to do this series is because we often cover books that are newly released by living authors, and yet we have this rich literary heritage that often goes unnoticed and untalked about, but it often begins in your local library. What else is on that shelf? What's after A? Or what are you picking up next as you kind of Ambrose Bierce.
I'll go to B, I guess. But, but yeah, there's all kinds of great stuff. And yeah, I love that you're doing this series because, yeah, so many of these books, historians, or authors, their life work was poured into these books. And, if they were published in 1950, something like this book was, maybe these books are forgotten later. But there's so many great stories in there. And this is such a colorful tale. The Flume, by the way, lasted about 10 years and did bring water to Rockerville and helped with some gold mining, but it just rotted and fell apart after that. The investors kind of lost all their money. So it's just a crazy tale. And then to think that Ambrose Bierce was in the middle of it, and you're able to learn that in this old book from the 50s was just great.
And somebody somewhere just realized that those amusement park rides called the Flume have a historical foundation, and they're going, why didn't I think of that before?
Well, there's an idea. Right, we should rebuild the Flume. What a great ride from Sheridan Lake to Rockerville. That'd be fantastic. I'd sign up for that.
As soon as we get that Amtrak through here, we'll work on next project infrastructure. And all right, what's on the shelves of your local library? Ask a librarian to help you find some treasures. Seth Tupper kicked us off. Thanks, Seth. And we want to hear your stories. What are those books that you love and have changed your lives that you found on your library shelf about South Dakota? We can't interview the author because they're long gone, but we can talk to you. Send us an email in the moment at sdpb.org. And now for some modern literature. In September of last year, poet Joshua Bennett joined in the moment to talk about his latest poetry collection called Ode. He spoke with Jackie Hendry. Now he has been named one of the winners of the 2021 Whiting Award. It's a $50,000 prize that acknowledges and supports the work of America's best writers. Previous winners include Layli Long Soldier and Tracy K. Smith. Bennett's forthcoming book explores a 50-year history of spoken word poetry in America. He's author of the powerful and lyrical work of literary criticism, Being Property Once Myself, Blackness and the End of Man. I spoke with Joshua Bennett this morning. Congratulations, first of all. What does this prize mean for you and the Guggenheim Fellowship and just all these things that have been happening to you, especially lately?
Yeah, so many different things. I mean, one, it means that we can fix our roof, which is actually the first thing I said quite embarrassingly to the Whiting Foundation when they called me. I said, we can fix the roof. Pam will be so happy. Pam is my wife. And she was really happy to hear the news. So yeah, on the one hand, so many practical considerations now can be taken care of in terms of just me being able to really focus on the writing and not having to worry about some of this stuff. I can put away money for my son's education. I can pay down my student loan debt. I can, hopefully take us all somewhere cool, in the coming year to celebrate the multitude of incredible things that happened. I just became a father about 6 months ago, and it's just been this incredible journey. So my inspiration even for applying for the Guggenheim was to have more time at home with my boy, August. So that's what I'm happiest about.
And it's the world, this is how I see it. It's the world saying, we want you to be able to fix your roof because we know that the work that you're doing and the work that you're doing in the future is so valuable to society that it deserves to be supported. That's how I kind of see it. You are working on this spoken word history, and your literary criticism in your last book was so lyrical and elegant and yet, pointed and punching. Most people think of you as a poet, but talk about this other sort of side of you that looks at history and education and literature and puts it together in new ways.
Sure. It's a beautifully phrased question, and thank you for it. It's complicated, When I was in graduate school, I was told pretty directly that I needed to stop writing poems or no one would take me seriously as a literary scholar. So I think part of what's been so astonishing about the past, what, I mean, I guess it's been about 5 years, right, since I finished graduate school, has been that actually the poetry at every turn has helped electrify the prose. You know, that doing literary criticism, doing the work of cultural history, I'm just not even sure how it would be possible for me if I weren't always reading and listening to poems, right? I mean, like you said, the prose work is about poetry, right? Yeah. And I tried to write, you know, the book that just came out of Harvard University Press, Being Property Once Myself, I tried to write it about novels, but if you look at the chapters, there's always poetry in there, right? Either the poetry is working at the level of an epigraph, or there are poems bookending my close reading of these canonical African-American novels. And so poetry is, it's just always with me, even in the prose. And I think I'm just quite taken with, I guess, the fact that poems come to us in moments where it seems like language fails, right? We recite poetry at funerals. We recite poetry at weddings. We recite poetry when children are born, right? Or at least my wife and I did, you know, yeah. That was an occasion for poetry. And so whenever I turn to the prose, I'm thinking, okay, well, how do I take that magic, that incredibly capacious sense of human possibility that I experience when I hear a poem, or even when I'm in the midst of reciting one on stage, and how do I put that into the prose? As my mentor, Imani Perry, you know, once instructed me, how do I commit to the beautiful sentence? And so that's what I've tried to do, you know, in my works of nonfiction so far.
Tell me a little bit about your earliest memories of what you now think as spoken word. Like when you were a child, you might not have thought of that, oh, that's spoken word, but the language that you were hearing was inspiring you, and you still carry it with you today, and now you understand its influence more richly.
Sure. I mean, that would have to be in the Black Baptist and Pentecostal churches in my youth, you know, seeing pastors deliver these incredible sermons. And even as I don't think I had a full sense of the kind of rhetorical brilliance on display, I did see how people reacted to it. Mm-hmm. I saw people cartwheel and shout and fall out. And I heard my mother say, you know, that's my word for the week. And the idea that language was something you could carry with you as a kind of armor, as a companion, right? That it would stick with you and protect you from a sort of violent world that misunderstood you at every turn. I think that was quite powerful, right? And I wanted to know, on the one hand, like how to tap into something like that, right? How to create that effect with language. But I think I also was just really committed to the idea that language could create these occasions for gathering, right? So I didn't discover Poetry Slam until, you know, I think I was about 13 or 14 years old. It was in Yonkers Public Library. There was a poetry slam, and my mom made me get up and do a poem, the one poem I had memorized at that point. Yeah. And I got second place. You know, she still has the trophy. And it was this incredible moment, you know, because yeah. I've always had, you know, pretty bad stage fright. But my mom told me, you know, a gift is to be shared. And so to this day, that's how I think about my practice as a performance artist, right? Like, it's about sharing and hoping that my particular story lands with someone else and helps them work through whatever they're working through.
Yeah. And then you also have this story also with your mother and the beauty shop and these women sort of encouraging you to understand the individual word and language in a very rewarding way as well. Tell us a little bit about that memory, please.
Wow, Laura, this is so well researched. I'm deeply moved and feel seen. Yeah, I mean, so in my grandmother's salon, you know, my grandmother at one point she owned and operated sort of three salons in Harlem. And the one I grew up in, you know, me and my big sister, we would get paid $1 when we would spell words that were longer than three syllables, right? So, you know, recalcitrant, loquacious, malfeasance. These are some of my favorite kind of go-to words in the early days. In no small part because a dollar, when you're a four-year-old boy, I mean, that you can do so much with that. You know how many kind of Swedish fish you could buy with a dollar? I mean, a great deal. So, and you can get a drink too, you know? And so that was this incredible environment in which I came to understand, and not just at a monetary level, right? But the value of education and what it meant to commit to study, right? Because I would go home and just pore over the dictionary, right? I was trying to create this reservoir of words that I could pull from at any time. And this is long before I had any dreams of becoming a literary scholar, right? I wasn't a self-identified poet. At least, you know, though I think I was practicing the thing in real time. And so those kind of social environments, they made all the difference for me as a child.
do you still discover a new word and unpack a word in a new way, as advanced as you are academically and as a performer and as a writer? Do you still come across things and go, wow, language is fantastic?
Oh, every single day, yeah. You know, and a lot of that, I think, is from spending time with my son. You know, his mother's generous enough to let me have the mornings with him, the early mornings, you know, and the sun is just rising. And in addition to sort of dancing the music together and, you know, kicking it, and I'll eat my breakfast, he eats his breakfast first, and we freestyle, right? And I guess in those early days, we're trying to find things that rhyme with August. I was sort of taken aback by the wealth of words that came to me, right? Like flawless, lawless, raucous, florist. And I think finding that kind of sequence was interesting because you need, you know, phrases, right? So I would think about my son shining like, you know, the inside of a florist shop. And there are just all sorts of new poems and lines that have come to me, I think, since he was born. So I've only written, really, I want to say 2.5 poems. Since he was born, so much of my time, you know, thankfully, it's with him. You know, it's trying to like cultivate this bond with this small boy who has my facial expressions. I mean, it's quite surreal. Yeah. So, yeah, to answer your question, I see new language all around me all the time.
Okay, so here's what I'm just dying to know: when you're in that moment, so okay, you've come to this place where you are not. No longer defining yourself only by the work that you put in the world. Like, what's the next collection going to be? You're, you know, taking in time with your son and you're just being present with him. But yet you are putting these words and this poetry into the world with an audience of two. Do you try to go write them down so that you have them later? Or is that enough in that moment to just speak those words into the world with your boy?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're synced up in this way, right? It's just, it goes to the air. You know, and it's just for me and him, which is this incredible thing a bit unprecedented for me. I mean, I started off freestyling with my big sister, and then freestyle ciphers were a big part of, you know, my time in undergrad and even after. But there's something in particular about the poem that's just for August, you know, and just in that moment. And then we'll make a new one the next day. It feels like this wonderful meditation on abundance. Like, hopefully we'll never run out. You know, and we have all these memories, you know, we'll be able to keep as he gets older, and hopefully, you know, we'll be exchanging poems, you know, soon, and going back and forth, and it'll be this gift that I hope I can, you know, share with him the same way my big sister shared it with me.
You can follow Joshua Bennett online at drjoshuabennett.com. He's on Twitter at Sir Josh Bennett. Bennett is spelled with two N's and two T's, by the way. We'll put links up to Dr. Bennett's work on our website under today's show notes. You can find those every day at sdpb.org/news. Well, we are going to close out this hour talking more about gifts to be shared and the stories that we release into the world, only this time here on In the Moment and across the great state of South Dakota and really across the world through our digital platforms as we continue our Sound Vision Capital campaign. And I'm joined here by Seth Tupper with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. He is in the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hills studio. Hey, welcome back, Seth.
Hey, Laurie. I've got the on-air light here on in the studio, so if anybody's passing by, they can see that. But yeah, good to be with you.
Yeah, yeah. This is the final phase of this vital campaign. Tell us a little bit, Seth, about what this challenge is all about and how people can be part of it.
Well, as you said, we're in the final phase of the campaign, and to inspire people to help us close it out, a group of generous donors has offered to match all gifts up to a total of $50,000. So by meeting this important challenge, we'll have a total of $100,000 to invest in inspiring programming and the resources that you rely on, including access to this beautiful Black Hills studio where I am today. Mm-hmm. SDPB, because of all these gifts and the things we have going with the studios in Sioux Falls and Rapid City, we have a great and exciting future ahead. That's why I came to work here. But we still need everybody's help to wrap up this critical campaign and help build the community one story at a time. And one person who has helped us do that today, I'd like to thank, is Kathy in Lake Preston, the home of the divers. Thank you, Kathy. You can join her by calling 800-333-0789 or giving online at sdpb.org.
Yeah, we are the South Dakota Storytellers, and one of the things that I just love about the book you told us about and about what Joshua Bennett was saying is sometimes we sit here on the radio and who knows how many people are listening? Who knows who will turn off the radio and then go home tonight and tell their loved one about the flume in Rockerville or about a poem they heard on the show today? You can't measure that. And one of the reasons that I love this time when we, you know, launch a campaign or tell people about it is we get to hear people call in and click donate and share their stories of what these stories mean to them. And that just, you know, that means so much to me as I do my work here, and I think to many of us. That is why we're here today, to urge you to make one of those special gifts above and beyond your annual membership. If you've never made a gift to SDPB, welcome. I'm excited for you to be here for the first time and to have the opportunity to invest in the future of this really incredible storytelling and journalism resource. Give online at sdpb.org or call 800-333-0789.
And as you said, Lori, I mean, you know, some of the interviews and some of the voices we've heard today on your show, you're not, you just don't hear that anywhere else in South Dakota, that kind of thing. And, you know, in order to keep that going and provide additional resources and more programming to serve our listeners in an even deeper and richer way, we're trying to build community. And we build community one story at a time. That's something that you see not only on the radio or here on the radio, but see on Dakota Life on TV, where they explore the winding roads of South Dakota and introduce us to people, places, and events and history that we all share and can be proud of as neighbors and citizens of our great state. And Brian Gevick, especially for people out here in the Black Hills, has produced a lot of stories about the characters and the tall tales that abound out here in the Black Hills, like we talked about with the Rockerville Flume earlier. He does a great job with that on Images of the Past. And your donation today to this campaign will help ensure that those kind of stories continue to be told here on our air.
Yeah, and you have access to this on television with South Dakota Focus with Jackie Hendry, and how she is, you know, texting me from being out in the field and meeting South Dakotans and capturing video and telling their stories. And that's what it is like to work here. How often my phone lights up that somebody that I work with is like, you're never going to believe who I met today. And do you know that they know so-and-so because so-and-so knows so-and-so? And you're going to love this story. And people like Jackie and Richard and Lee Strubinger and Seth Tupper and so many more people that I'm forgetting right now, sorry, are out there doing that work every day. We're so excited about the stories that we bring to you, and we feel that excitement from you in return. So now is your chance to help us continue through contributing to the Sound Vision campaign. You help us out all the time. Give an additional gift right now for that investment in the future. Go online, sdpb.org, call 800-333-0789, or again, click and donate, sdpb.org. Thank you for listening.